Well, thank you, Mr. Menzel. And happy Sabbath, brethren. I wish we had to could stop saying that we could see all your smiling faces and just actually see them. It'd be really nice. Look forward to the day when we'll all be together again. But we'll just have to continue to content ourselves with just imagining you all there. I think the last time that I saw many of you was, in person at least, was probably late January now. It's been a long time. Of course, that now seems like ages ago in many ways, and the world today just seems like an entirely different place with how much has changed. I tell you, if I'd known in January what I know now, I'd definitely use one of my Costco runs to buy some toilet paper. I think it was December when we had last purchased some. And then when we got back from Italy in late February, toilet paper had gone into full swing. A few weeks back, I'd attempted a couple Costco runs that involved getting up well before sunrise and waiting a long line in the cold only to finally get in the store to see empty shelves. Empty shelves, leaving me disappointed and paperless. Thankfully, a couple weeks ago, my mother-in-law stepped in and saved the day by snagging a pack for us during senior hours. And when I finally held that pack in my hot little hands, well, I'm not sure if you've heard of the professional home organizer, Marie Kondo, or not. She has a Netflix show where she tells her clients to pick up items in their home and only keep the ones that, quote, spark joy. Well, I can tell you, that 36-pack of Charmin Ultra Soft really sparked joy for me that day. Of course, toilet paper isn't the only thing that's vanished from the shelves. I never thought I'd see the day when the entire meat section of Costco was devoid of chicken as well. I think we've all experienced these changes recently. I'm sure we all have, in fact. And especially at first, was it jarring? When we are so used to having something, you know, day after day, year after year, shopping trip after shopping trip, you expect that it will always be there. It can feel strange, even a bit unjust, when we go to the grocery store to get something that's always been there and it's gone. The right to purchase toilet paper? Or chicken? Or pasta? Is this as an American? When you've always had something and you feel like you have the right to it, that it's almost owed to you, and it feels rather unjust when you no longer have it. Now, logically, we know that the Constitution doesn't guarantee us the right to life, liberty, and organic, boneless, skinless chicken breasts, but that feeling is certainly there. I saw an article recently about a couple who bragged about buying all the meat in a grocery store. Literally, two shopping carts fit piled high, leaving none for anyone else. Was that rude and inappropriate? Absolutely. But the response they received is what really stood out. After the picture was posted of the couple with their carts heaping with meat, they quickly began receiving death threats. Death threats. Over ground. Now, if the unjust appropriation of meat can elicit such a strong response, I'd like you to imagine how you might feel if something truly valuable was taken from you. If someone was told from their youth that they were entitled to something great, only to see that prize go to someone else. And that's where I'd like to begin today. You are a prince, the legitimate and recognized heir to your nation's throne. But you're not some spoiled and entitled dandy issuing orders from on high, making others do the hard and dirty work while you rest at home in your comfortable throne, taking all the credit. No, you are a man of action, a true leader, brave and courageous. You've spent your days fighting, sacrificing, risking life and limb to free your people from cruel and evil nations on every side. Nations of far greater military might than yours. But despite the seemingly overwhelming disadvantage that you have, you risk everything to free your people, trusting in God's victory. And he does. Even working great miracles through you. Imagine that you've lived a righteous and selfless life. On top of all this, you are a good son, a good father, the best of friends, a competent and talented leader who fears and respects God and loves his neighbor. There's nothing about you that doesn't suggest that you will be a truly great king. By legitimate right of succession and by your own merits, you've done everything you can to prepare yourself to rule. But then God decrees that it will not be so. And why? Because you showed you to no longer be worthy? Because you turned from your righteous ways? No. You would not be king because of the actions, the sins of your father. Jonathan, firstborn son of King Saul, can often be overshadowed by the bigger characters that surround him in the Bible, by David and Saul and Samuel. Verses written about Jonathan, we uncover a truly remarkable individual. A person who seems like he deserved to be the hero of the story, as it were. And yet, he is relegated to a more minor role, a supporting role, because of the sins of others. Today, I'd like to look at the story of Jonathan, first prince of Israel. And I'd like to pull some lessons from his life and example. Three lessons from the life of Jonathan, the man who could have been king. Three lessons from the life of Jonathan, the man who could have been king. And the first lesson, we should embrace the role that God has given us. We should embrace the role that God has given us. We first meet Jonathan after his father has been king of Israel for some years. The Israelites' current oppressor is the Philistines, who have removed every blacksmith from the land of Israel, so that the Israelites would be unable to make weapons in order to defend themselves. They couldn't even sharpen their tools without traveling to the land of the Philistines to have them sharpen them for them. In fact, in their entire army, the Bible says that only King Saul and Jonathan himself had a sword or spear, not anyone else. Presumably, the rest of them are armed with nothing but farm implements and tools, making them resemble more of a ragtag mob of peasants, more professional. Let's pick up the story here in 1 Samuel 15. Excuse me, 1 Samuel 13. I have a misprint in my notes. 1 Samuel 13. And we'll start reading in verse 2. First Samuel 13, 2. Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash, mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. And Jonathan attacked the Philistine that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." Now all Israel heard it, said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines. And the people were called together to Saul. Then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is seashore multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth-Avon. 30,000. 30,000 chariots. That's like 30,000 battle tanks in modern warfare terms. And on top of that, the Philistines had and an uncountable number of infantry, no doubt armed with actual real weapons. And on the Israelite side, that ragtag mob of peasants armed with farm implements. Not exactly promising odds, to say the least. And the Israelites, seeing this, responded accordingly and fled in panic. Picking up in verse 6, when the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. It's amazing that Saul and his army stayed together at all, really. By all physical measures, they had no hope of victory, no hope of victory in the upcoming battle. And soon it would seem to Saul and his remaining men like even any hope of divine intervention would be gone as well, as Samuel was slow to arrive to offer sacrifices to God and seek his intervention in the coming battle before it was too late. At least slow in their eyes. Continuing in verse 8. Then Saul waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal. He scattered from him. So Samuel didn't arrive when Saul expected him. So he too panicked. And foolishly, he chose to offer the sacrifices to God himself, which only God's priests were allowed to do. Samuel had specifically warned Saul, in fact, not to do this in a prophecy that he had given Saul years before. But Saul did not obey, giving into his fear. Continuing in verse 9. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me. I made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Saul's heirs would have reigned over Israel forever, it says. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. King Saul lost God's support as king due to his disobedience. And as a result of Saul's actions, Jonathan would suffer these consequences as well. He would not inherit his father's throne. Though no fault of his was committed, Jonathan would not become king of Israel. How did he respond to this? How did Jonathan respond? Did he speak out against this injustice? Did he complain to God that he had done nothing wrong? Why? Why should he suffer the consequences of his father's actions? What had he done since he had been raised to expect, which he had diligently been preparing to receive? Let's continue the story in the next chapter. Let's read 1 Samuel 14. We'll start in 6. 1 Samuel 14 and verse 6. We'll see Jonathan's response. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, have you lost your mind? There's only two of us, and I don't even have a sword. It'd be suicide. No, that's not what he said. But you think it should have been. Instead, he said to Jonathan, do all that is in your heart. Go then, here I am with you. Let's just pause there a moment. What kind of person would you follow in this situation? By any human measure, this is a suicide mission. Now, everyone else around you has run from the Philistine army to hide in caves, such that only 600 of you remain in your little army. And Jonathan says, hey, we don't need these other 598 guys. How about I go attack those 30,000 chariots over there by ourselves? I like them odds. Even at this point in his life, Jonathan must have been a remarkable man to elicit this kind of loyalty from his armor bearer. Let's continue on in verse 8. And then Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men, and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. God had just decreed that Jonathan would not receive the kingship that he had been raised to expect, had been preparing himself to receive the king of Israel. Shouldn't he have been outraged, frustrated, or at least expressed some disappointment? But the response that we read from Jonathan was not merely to accept God's judgment, but to step out courageously, putting his faith, putting his very life in God's hands, the God who had just revoked his inheritance. Let's continue in verse 11. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden. Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan, and his armor bearer said, come up to us, and we will show you something. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and his knees with his armor bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Jumping down to verse 20. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth-Aven. As a result of Jonathan's bravery and reliance on God, God sent an earthquake to send the Philistines into a panic, and their massive army turned on itself. And soon the Israelites were in victorious pursuit of the Philistine hordes. Jonathan appears to have accepted God's judgment, accepted that he would not be king, and more than that, he embraced the path that God had set before him, putting his trust in God's decision for him. Sometimes life doesn't work out the way that we'd like, or as we planned, or even as we've been taught to expect. Sometimes our prayers are not answered in the way that we would like. We don't receive the things that we might merit, or even the things that we've earned. But God has a plan and a purpose for each of us. In 1 Corinthians 12, for your notes, it's 1 Corinthians 12:18, we're told that God has a role for each of us, that he places everyone in the body of Christ where he chooses to fulfill our role. And in Romans 8:28, we're told that all things ultimately work for good, though called. We may not understand why God has given us the roles that he has, but we can trust that he set us on the right path, leading us where we need to go, ultimately to a kingship, priesthood, and we should do our best to embrace it. A second lesson that we can learn from the life of Jonathan is that love casts out envy. That love casts out envy. The story of David and Goliath is certainly one of the most famous and well-known in the Bible. Even among non-religious types, they've heard of the story. It seems like everyone loves an underdog story. You know, the brave young shepherd who defeated the giant warrior, who dared to fight when no one else would, armed with nothing but a sling and a shepherd's staff. Not even King Saul, the warrior, who stood a full head taller than every other Israelite, dared to face Goliath in single combat. And God granted David the victory. And as a result, the Philistines fled in panic. Their army scattered, and King Saul's army was an incredible victory against them. And how did King Saul feel? How did he feel toward David for this amazing act of courage and sacrifice? He became bitterly envious of him very quickly. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 18. Just over a couple pages to 1 Samuel 18. And we'll start in verse 6. Now what had happened as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. And so the women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." And Saul was very angry. And he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from the day forward. Saul eyed David with suspicion. Saul remembered that God had promised that he'd be replaced as king of Israel for his disobedience. I can't imagine a day would go by that he didn't think about this. You know, such a strong and harsh thing. No doubt he was on the lookout for those whom God might select as king in his place, those who would replace him. And Saul quickly demonstrated that he was not at all willing to submit to God's judgment and give his throne to another. Let's read a bit further in verse 10. And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul outside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. When David defeated Goliath, Saul quickly became envious, and then resentful, and then hateful, even seeking to kill David on multiple occasions. Jonathan had all the same reasons to be envious of David, just like Saul. And yet Jonathan responded very differently. He loved David like his own soul from the day that David slew Goliath for the rest of his life. How did Jonathan resist the urge? How did he resist the urge to envy and resent, even hate David as Saul did? Have you ever tried to take the air out of a cup? Seems like an odd question, perhaps. You know, probably not. It sounds crazy. You know, impossible, even. You know, you can't scoop the air out. You can't turn the cup upside down and dump out all the air. It's air. You know, it's going to stay in that cup no matter how much you shake things or flip around. But there's a trick. And once you know the trick, it stops being impossible and starts being rather laughably easy. Water. You know, you just add water. The trick to getting air out of a cup is to focus on replacing the air, not just removing it. By adding water or dirt or chocolate milkshake or quick-set concrete, whatever's handy, you can force the air out of the cup by making sure there's no room for it anymore. Saul greatly envied David. His cup was full to the brim with envy. And throwing a little hate and resentment as well, of course. But Jonathan's cup had no room for envy. And any envy Jonathan had toward David had been driven out by love. Like water driving the air out of a cup. Let's look back at 1 Samuel 18, and this time we'll start reading in verse 1. 1 Samuel 18:1. Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him in his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. All the symbols of Jonathan's office and rank. Any envy, resentment, or hate that Jonathan might have had was expelled by his brotherly love toward David. Jonathan's love for David was so great, it left no room for envy. And for the rest of his life, he would defend and support David, even against his own father, even at risk to his own life. In any other story like this, down through history, Jonathan and David would have been mortal enemies. Two men fighting to the death over the same throne. And by any human reasoning, these men should not have been friends. But Jonathan wasn't operating by human reasoning, or following human laws of succession, for that matter. He was operating under a higher understanding. He had love for David that left no room for envy. And he recognized that his loyalty must be placed in something bigger than his bloodline. Which brings me to our third and final point for today. Our third and final point for today. And that is that we must have loyalty to God above all others. We must have loyalty to God above all others. Oftentimes you see on television today, or even experience in real life, situations where people expect their friends or family to be loyal to them no matter what, to support their decisions no matter what, for good or for evil. You know, whether they make really bad decisions and dangerous decisions or really good ones, they expect absolute loyalty and support. That's the true mark of a friend, is it not? That's what real family does, isn't it? Loyalty is certainly a noble attribute, but first and foremost, our loyalty must be to God, to what is right, no matter who opposes us, no matter who pressures us to do otherwise. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 19, and we'll start reading in verse 1. 1 Samuel 19:1. Now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son, and all his servants, that they should kill. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning, and stay in a secret place and hide. Out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. And what I observe, I will tell you." Wow. Father's done for him. Isn't that how the world would interpret this passage? It wasn't just a matter of Jonathan's being loyal to David over Saul. Jonathan was being loyal to God over Saul. And David was in the right. He was the innocent target of Saul's evil intentions. Let's continue reading in verse 4. Thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause? So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. So Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Oh, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Jonathan was a peacemaker. Now, he could have chosen to simply side with David. Now, his father was in the wrong, after all. But instead, he sought to heal the breach between them. Now, to make peace between the father that he loved and the friend that he loved as well. And in doing so, he remained loyal to both of them, looking out for both of their interests. But above all, he was loyal to God and what was right. In researching this message, I had originally thought to focus on Jonathan's wonderful example of friendship and what we could learn from that, you know, as people often do. But the more I studied about him, the more I read, the more I saw that Jonathan was so much more than David's. So much more than some minor character overshadowed by the likes of David and Saul and Samuel. In any other story, he would have been the main character, the hero of the story, as it were. But in point of fact, Jonathan was a hero, a truly inspiring hero of faith. Man, you know, a man who had such incredible potential and courage and goodness, who would have done so much good for Israel as its king, and yet he humbly embraced the role that God had given him. And more than that, he wholeheartedly threw his support beyond God's choice of David as king. Let's turn to just one last verse, the last recorded time that Jonathan and David ever saw one another. Let's read 1 Samuel 12, verse 16. 1 Samuel 23, verse 16. Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, do not fear. My father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that. We may feel disappointed at times in this life that we're not able to make the most of our talents, you know, make the most of our skills and potential. We might feel frustrated and held back at times by our circumstances. We might feel that we haven't received what we've earned. We might feel limited or unsatisfied with our circumstances or the role that we're set to play. I think it's helpful to remember that whatever our role in this life, whatever the path that God has laid for each of us, at the end of that path, at the end of that role, we look forward to being kings and priests in his kingdom. Whatever that path may be, we will be given all the opportunity, all the reward we could ever hope for. All our talents will be put to use. There will be no limitations. Everything we could ever hope to inherit will be ours if we trust in God and keep our focus on his ultimate plan for us and our eternal role that has been prepared for us. Jonathan was not granted a physical kingship in this physical life, but God knew the path that would best prepare him to receive and fulfill his role in God's kingdom. And if we follow Jonathan's example and embrace the role that God has given us and fill our hearts to the brim with God's love and stay loyal to God above all else, we can trust that God will do the same for us. Hope you all have a wonderful Sabbath.